I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue Tuesday, May 14th. We have a number of items on our agenda. I'm starting with a public hearing that we're continuing from yesterday. And as soon as we have all the members here, we will be doing work sessions on bills that we need to get moving along their way. And then we will continue public hearings. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3023A.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
20 seconds.
As you just mentioned, this is just a continuation of the public hearing that we still had some testimony signed up for yesterday on 3023. There's the dash A14 amendment. Again, that's in all us. Other than that, we've received nothing new since yesterday.
Okay, great. Thank you. The first panel will be Jim McCauley, Stacy Cowan, Ethan Nelson. And after that, we will hear from Sean Miller, Carla McQuillan, and Guy Ocker. And we're going to have to keep to the same 2 minutes that the speakers yesterday were gracious enough to comply with. Thank you.
Yeah, fair enough. Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Marsh and Finley, Jim McCauley, representing the League of Oregon Cities. I want to be clear from the beginning that LOC opposes House Bill 3023 as well as the dash 14 amendments. We believe there is a better template that's available, and we believe that with a relatively new and emerging business model, you must proceed with caution at the very least. I've put together quite a bit of information on this that I certainly shared with the committee. A lot has been written about it in terms of TNC's emergence across the country, and I think the most important issue to kind of think about is really in terms of the transportation element here and the impacts on transportation. Because under the current model that's within HB 3023, cities have no course, no opportunity to essentially regulate those local sources. This is all essentially done at ODOT with an agency that has zero experience dealing with TNCs or dealing with that type of a business model. The only entities in Oregon that you have that have got the breadth of knowledge or the breadth of experience in this is really the city of Portland and the city of Eugene. And I think you need to pay attention to the experience that they've had over the last several years and be informed with that process as you proceed with some type of a statewide model, if that's ultimately the outcome here. We'd like to see a statewide model ourselves within the league, but we have to make sure that we still have an opportunity for cities to be part of that conversation and essentially be part of that regulatory involvement if they so choose. There's no question that there are smaller cities out there that may not want to take that part, but there are plenty of models out there across this country that have a certain nuance and are not just simply done by the state. You have multiple cities, whether it's large or small, that have that opportunity at this stage. I kind of draw from the Washington model at this point. You've got 32 different cities, 3 counties, 2 airports that are all part of essentially a regulatory structure up there. And I think that needs to be part of the template as you look at this for Oregon.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Stacy Cowan with the City of Portland. I'm here on behalf of Noah Siegel. He apologizes he wasn't able to make it back today. Noah is our Assistant Director for Portland Bureau of Transportation. His complete testimony is available on OLIS. I encourage you to read that. I'll provide a quick summary of his presentation. So, City of Portland is opposed to House Bill 3023 and the dash A14 amendment. 4 years ago, there were no TNC trips on Portland streets. Last year in Portland, there were over 12 million private for hire rides. These are big changes that offer many exciting opportunities, but also considerable risk. Our streets belong to us. Maintaining the public's interest will take thoughtful, dynamic regulatory framework with a role for the state and a role for local jurisdictions working together. Please consider the following areas: consumer safety. Background checks, education, and safety practices, and especially review and enforcement, are critical for consumer protection. The dash A14 amendment, while recognizing the need for at least some basic regulation, falls far short, while also fully preempting more stringent local protections. When it comes to services with for people with disabilities, this bill also falls short of providing a framework that will support services to people with disabilities. It's important to note that House Bill 3023 only allows communities with more than 90,000 people to charge a per ride surcharge to pay for the WAVE program. And importantly, TNCs are not required to participate. So what this means in the city of Portland is that a person can access the WAVE program through the app as well as any regular ride. This bill does not require that type of participation. When it comes to congestion, Uber and Lyft claim that they are not contributing to congestion. This is not true. Last year, nearly 5% of the trips in and out of our central city at rush hour were made by TNCs. This does not count the traffic that was created for the many trips without passengers. I'll just quickly close and say the industry is evolving. It's important that we take this slow and that we get this policy right. We think that this bill is absolutely the wrong way to go. We urge you not to pass this legislation and continue thinking thoughtfully about the best way to approach a statewide framework.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. My name is Ethan Nelson, and I'm here representing the city of Eugene. We are strongly opposed to House Bill 3023. I know we've spent time discussing this with most of you, but for I think there's mainly put in our testimony on into the record so you can read that in full. I'll focus in on three main points that are most germane for us. Eugene has a system that's working. We, like Portland, negotiated with TNCs to create a system that is efficient and implements the program for our communities at the request of business and community members. And at the same time, it implements the interests of the city council, our elected officials, in regards to their interests and support for public safety and consumer protection. We believe that House Bill 3023 would preempt, it obviously does preempt, and it would gut basically those provisions that we find are most important for our community. And they wouldn't provide any kind of replacement for those consumer protections and public safety concerns. We've, over the past just over 6 months since we've reinitiated our program, we've had over 1,300 applicants come in, come on out. And out of that, there's a background check that the TNCs complete. And the City of Eugene does a secondary certification with our Eugene Police Department. And there was over around 40 applicants who came through the TNC process but then did not pass ours, and those include a number of felons, misdemeanors, and convicted sex offenders. I think the second point is that this was not a work group bill. We participated in a work group bill, which was House Bill 3379. The industry states that it is a work group bill. It is not. We would like to have the opportunity to participate in a true interim work group that would bring together all of the stakeholders that are very interested in landing public policy that matters for this state, and Oregon can do better. I encourage you to look at the work that we put together to look at the difference between the ODOT recommendations for implementing this and then what the Dash 14s don't carry through from that ODOT recommendation. And so kind of in closing, I thank you for your time, apologize for going over, and I ask you to oppose this bill.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. The next panel, I believe that was Sean Miller, Carla McQuillan, Guy Ocker. And after that, we will hear from Orlando Lopez, Ben Pollack, Chris Hagerbaumer.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the American Property Casualty Insurance Association in support of House Bill 3023. And I'll just briefly try to answer a couple questions that were raised yesterday, one from Representative Finley and then one from Representative Smith-Warner. And the first one, I think Representative Finley asked, what are we trying to solve? And on the insurance portions of the bill, and I can only speak to sections 8 and 9, starting on page 7, What we're trying to do is we're the last state to basically adopt statewide insurance standards on TNCs. So I know the bill addresses a lot of different issues, but on the insurance side, again, drafting and adopting those statewide insurance standards where we have a clear delineation between your personal auto policy and then your TNC policy. So when the app goes on, you're in period one, waiting for a match, you're in period two, passenger not yet in your car, or you're in the passenger enters your car, there's a clear understanding of the insurance coverage. We have a statewide insurance code, and therefore all the cities have adopted the same insurance regulations that we have done in all our other states. And so doing the statewide insurance code is important consumer protection for all the other folks in the state of Oregon. Second question I think that was raised yesterday is this question of a ceiling, not a floor. And on the insurance side, again, we have a statewide insurance code, not local insurance codes. And therefore, having this particular protection, whether you drive from one city, Medford, into Ashland, or Ashland back into Medford, having that statewide insurance coverage is very important. And again, that clear delineation between your personal auto policy and your TNC policy. And so I'm happy to provide any more detail on that. But again, when it comes to the insurance side, sections 8 and 9, we do support that statewide. And again, thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, I'm Carla McQuillan, president of the National Federation of the Blind of Oregon, and I am here speaking in support of House Bill 3023. As a blind individual, I used fixed route transit in the Eugene area all the time. However, it does not go out to the airport. And one of the things that's been particularly difficult for me as a blind individual is I do travel a lot, and getting to the airport with the regular cab system in Eugene is particularly early in the morning is nearly impossible. And I think it's interesting to hear about how Portland, the cities of Portland and Eugene got it together with the ride share. I know I traveled all over the country with Uber and Lyft years before we had anything like that in Eugene. And even when it was finally approved, after all the battles, as you know, Chair, Eugene can't do anything quickly. It ended up that there were so few drivers and the process took so long that it was actually more expensive to take an Uber or a Lyft in town than it was the regular cab system. So I am in support for the reasons that in smaller communities, we have a lot of members who live out in smaller communities in the state, and it's just more difficult for them to establish the rules and regulations and procedures, whereas this would be a model they could walk right into without wasting a great deal of time, and then being able to offer the same quality and accessibility of transportation for people who do not drive that we have in larger cities such as Portland and across the country. Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Guy Ocker, and I live in Scappoose, Oregon, and I'm an Uber driver for 4 years, and I'm pushing almost 12,000 rides in these 4 years. I do it full time. First of all, I want to say ditto to the last part, what she said about the small communities and about how they're underserved. I do want to add one thing is I really, my goal, and one of my goals is I want people to have a safe ride home after they've been out with friends and drinking. And in these small communities, what is happening is they, not everyone, but there's just a small group saying, hey, you know, I've only had 2 or 3 beers, so, you know, I'm fine, I'll just drive home. Whereas if we had Uber and Lyft throughout the state, they could have that option. There's another thing I would like to really let you know that I'm kind of confused about is driving here to the state capitol today. I saw a UPS freight truck driving down the freeway, and I thought to myself, like, well, wait a minute, do they have to get a special permit in every city to perform their city, or are they state throughout the state. Well, they are there through the state, through the Department of Transportation, and this should be the same thing. They have this. They have, you know, very stringent rules. Whereas this 3023 would also have stringent rules. So, I look at the UPS freight and the trucking industry, and this is the same thing, where they're statewide. And that's the way it should be. I just really want, lastly, I just want to emphasize about it's about safety, and I want people to get rides home safely. And these small cities, rural communities don't have it, and they should be allowed to have it. And having us will become easier and more less, I'm going to call it bureaucracy, that they have to go through to come into these cities.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Orlando Lopez, Ben Pollock, Chris Hagerbaumer. After that will be Jordan Bice and Randy Tucker. That completes the list I had, and one more. Okay.
Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, my name is Chris Hagerbaumer. I'm with the Oregon Environmental Council, and I thank you for the opportunity to address you this morning. We're here in opposition specifically to Section 2 of House Bill 3023, which is the preemption on local governments. I've been working on transportation issues in Oregon for 23 years, and I see I'm actually super excited about the future with including the new mobility options that we will have. I think there's a lot of opportunity, but I'm also frankly terrified that we might get it wrong. So unfortunately, real world experience is showing that TNCs are adding more trips, more miles, and more greenhouse gas emissions. They're actually adding to congestion and replacing trips that would have been made by transit, walking, and biking. There was a report that just came out last week that showed that in San Francisco, TNCs are adding more than half of the congestion that they've experienced in recent years, that growth in congestion. And they're also not really providing the kind of data that cities need, that transportation planners need, in order to make sure that these are operating the right way in our communities. So we do appreciate that the bill was amended to look at the amendment related to wheelchair accessibility, to EV charging infrastructure. There's a nod towards shared data for planning purposes, but let me give you an example right there. In that, it says the word may, that a city may work with TNCs. And you know that that could easily be stonewalled when you have the word may. And even if a city were able to enter into an agreement with the TNC to get data, that data is very limited. So it would not allow a city to figure out whether a TNC is adding to, or is, for example, taking away trips from transit, or whether it's actually supporting transit. It's just not enough data to figure that out. And if you think about it, the low-income people in our community, they need transit the most, and we really cannot allow TNCs to continue to eviscerate transit service, which is very needed by those folks. So thank you so much for your time.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Ben Pollock, and I'm here representing Bus Riders Unite. Uber and Lyft claim that they provide affordable transportation, but as someone living on Social Security disability, they seem out of touch. I don't have a car because it is too costly, and because TNCs are so expensive, I have to rely on public transit as my only option for transportation. It cost me $20 to get a ride downtown, which is only a 20-minute drive. As the number of Uber and Lyft drivers has increased, I have had to wait longer and longer for the bus and the train, and my trips have taken more and more of my time. As a disabled person, I have to travel to a lot of doctor's appointments around the region, and they're spread very far and wide. My experience over decades of dependence on mass transit has taught me to plan extra time in order to avoid being late. However, in the past year, I've missed two appointments because my bus took far longer than the schedule said it would. Both times they were on the same bus line, and both times because we were stuck in traffic. We desperately need funding and flexibility to improve and prioritize transit service in our communities, and transportation networking companies and their customers have a responsibility to contribute to and to cooperate with those efforts. In that vein, it should be said that the desire for statewide regulation of TNCs is understandable, and I support that, but not the desire to preempt local control. In general, statewide regulations should only represent the floor of regulation and taxation. It is not controversial to say that local jurisdictions do not always share priorities, creating a need for different levels of regulation. Specifically, cities with concentrations of TNC drivers have congestion problems arising from their presence, which are not faced in rural areas. Therefore, cities should be able to enact stronger regulations and higher taxes to balance the burden this congestion places on our mass transit systems. For example, the model set by New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, and Washington, D.C. is just such a balanced approach that prioritizes the needs of folks with poor access to transportation, with the impact that TNC operations have on congestion in cities and the needs of workers who just want to feed their families. Thank you very much for your time.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and members of the committee. My name is Orlando Lopez, and I'm a Lyft and Uber driver who has been driving for 2 years now. I really appreciate the work that, and attention that you have given this new, pretty much this new business that's impacting our transportation system. As drivers, we are told that we're independent contractors, but these apps control almost every aspect of how we do our work, how much we are paid, and who else we can partner with. They deactivate drivers with no clear way to appeal, prevent us from partnering up with advertising companies. And over the 2 years that I've been working for these companies, they've already cut the rates twice. Since they've been operating, they've cut it three times. I've already talked to a number of drivers who said that if there's another cut, they will stop driving altogether. We need your help to clarify whether we are employees or contractors. This is the duty of the state, not Lyft and Uber. Local cities say they are preempted by the state to set a minimum wage, yet Lyft and Uber continue to cut our rates. New York State allows the city of New York to establish a rate that averages about $26 an hour, so that after expenses, drivers take home $17 an hour. Many drivers in Oregon are earning well under the minimum wage. I agree that Uber and Lyft should operate throughout the state, but I am opposed that a statewide law that preempts local cities from regulating TNCs. These companies have vastly different impacts on different markets. I know that a lot of you wish to see these companies operate in rural communities, but this won't happen for the same reason that taxis do not operate in rural communities. The person that spoke before me about from Skepoos, who said that he's given over 12,000 rides, most of those were given in Portland, I can assure you. Because one, like, no driver is gonna go out of their way out to a rural community to pick up a ride, knowing that they're gambling, that they're only gonna be getting $3 in return for that trip. So it's the same reason that taxis don't operate in rural communities. In terms of equity, I can tell you that both of these companies are failing, because you have to have access to a smartphone data with data, debit and credit card, and money to pay for the service. A simple 5-mile ride costs well more than $17 an hour, $17 for the ride. So again, I oppose this bill, and I hope you consider HB 3379 as an alternative. Thank you.
For your testimony. Next, we will hear from Jordan Bice, Randy Tucker, and Arthur Towers.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Finley and Marsh, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jordan Bice. I'm here representing TechNet, a trade association of over 80 tech companies ranging from small startups to some of the world's largest employers. I'm here in support of House Bill 3023, the bill that will set statewide permitting standards for transportation network companies, or TNCs. 3023 establishes a cleaner permitting system in Oregon that is good for consumers, good for drivers, good for the state, and encourages the innovation economy. Thanks to the work of Representative McLean, the bill before you creates a safer, unified program that opens doors for countless Oregonians who otherwise might have mobility issues. With one set of standards for the state, a TNC driver could take you from Eugene to Ashland, or if you're really ambitious, Ashland to Ontario, under one umbrella of regulations for every community that you pass through. One of the best things about this bill is that it connects all of Oregon's communities. Along with infrastructure and transit improvements, innovation and technology are improving the safety, efficiency, and sustainability of Oregon's transportation system. The state has made strong commitments to transportation, and we hope that this bill can be a part of Oregon's mobility future. We encourage your support for 3023, and thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. As you know, Metro is responsible for transportation planning in the Portland metropolitan region. We work collaboratively with our local government partners to accomplish that and to develop an efficient and reliable transportation system. The Metro Council opposes House Bill 3023. I'll call your attention to a letter that from multiple governments, including Metro, that's in OLIS. As part of our legislative agenda this session, the council supports legislation that doesn't related to emerging transportation technologies like these TNCs, automated vehicles, and dockless technologies that does not preempt local governments, and that ensures appropriate level of data sharing with local governments. You've heard a lot about preemption already. Let me just talk a little bit about data sharing. You've heard a little bit of that from Ms. Hagerbaumer. Sharing detailed data on TNCs is critical to getting the right regulations and policies in place and making sure that companies follow them. We know that TNCs generally increase vehicle miles traveled and congestion because of national research. To address those issues, local and regional agencies need local data so we can design and manage our streets to mitigate these negative impacts. TNC's travel patterns evolve quickly. We need data to keep up. For example, cities can use data on where TNC trips begin and end to designate pickup and drop-off zones that minimize confusion and congestion and keep streets safe for all travelers. It would be cost prohibitive and ineffective to do this by sending people out into the streets to count cars. And so there's other reasons for data sharing. Basically, you know, we're not calling for personally identifiable data to be shared or trade secret data, but certainly aggregated data, accident data, you know, the kind of things that can help to manage the system more effectively. There are some best practices already in place in the city of Portland and other cities in the state. I think some of these cities have shown some leadership, and this legislation would move Oregon from a leader to a laggard in the effort to integrate these new technologies into our communities. So thank you for your time.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Arthur Towers. I'm the political director for the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. OTLA members are the ones who fight for the rights of victims of car crashes, and we strongly oppose House Bill 3023A in its current form. The bill as it's written extends two loopholes for TNCs to operate in which they provide very limited insurance. Thank you for putting the testimony up on the screen as opposed to on my phone. the big deal is that TNCs are not required to provide personal injury protection insurance, and that's the insurance that you have that is on all private passenger vehicles that says that when you get hurt, that first $15,000 in medical bills or lost wages are paid relatively quickly, so that as a consumer, you aren't quickly thrown into debt if you can't get those immediate bills paid. In the Business and Labor Committee, when this was originally heard, there was testimony about the human impact of that lack of coverage. And we feel that TNC should have that coverage. 3023 doesn't require it. The second loophole is that the bill allows TNCs to elect the minimum standards for crashes involving uninsured and underinsured motorists. They could elect to choose $25,000 worth of coverage as opposed to the $1 million that we feel that they should be providing. And so for those two reasons, we strongly oppose the legislation and would hope that the committee would consider that if you do go forward, there should be a statewide insurance standard that's at least a floor, and it should be much, much stronger than what we have in 3023. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for your testimony. That completes our list of people who have signed up for today's hearing. Is there anyone that I missed in the audience? Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee, or are we ready to move on?
Madam Chair, I have one quick question.
Yes.
I guess I'd like the question for LRO is there's the fee structure and the monies collected in here appears to me to be a tax. I mean, we're collecting ride cost and moving it to other unrelated programs. That would be a tax in my mind. And I guess I'd like an answer, a clean definition of that. And if so, if it is a tax, and it would require a 3/5 vote to establish this bill. The money that goes into this pot and funds electric charging stations is not related to this rideshare program, and I don't believe could be called a fee.
Yeah, Representative Finley, I think at this point it's step into the, we'd want to speak with legislative council and confer with them and then get back to you.
Thank you.
Good. Look forward to hearing from you at a later date. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3023A. Thank you, everyone, for coming back today. Still missing one member. I'm not moving to work sessions yet. I'm going to open another public hearing. But we will open work sessions as soon as all of us are here. A public hearing on Senate Bill 213A.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 213A is an annual bill that the Revenue Committee generally will see, and this is the update bill to the connection date to the Internal Revenue Code. So there is a document up in OLS under the media materials for 213A that is a section by section description of this bill, so we can get that pulled up here. And again, this is a bill that the committees will see generally on an annual basis. Again, as a brief reminder, Oregon connects to the federal Internal Revenue Code in two distinct ways to categorize it. The first is our connection to the federal definition of taxable income, and the second is a series of point-in-time connections to federal IRC statute. So the bill you see in front of you here is really about those point-in-time connections. So each session, there will be a bill where those point-in-time connections are updated for an additional year, for going from generally it's going to be December 31st of, say, 2017 up to December 31st, 2018. So it's capturing any changes in the Internal Revenue Code that are applicable to the different sections. Again, for this year, we didn't see any changes of significance from this point in time connection bill, and that's the reason for the minimal and the no fiscal impact statement. And these sections, again, they start off relating to a series of sections 2 through 12 related to the PERS plans. There's also some connection to some property tax statutes as well that are listed there. And just another note on this, on the bill, that originally this came out of the Senate, and there was some discussion about possibly making changes to how Oregon connected. And one of those was ending the rolling reconnect. So that's our connection to the definition of taxable income. That was taken out of the bill. But that's part of the reason you see a couple sections there that were included, were not renumbered, and they're in red and kind of has the line going through them. That's just showing that language was removed, but it wasn't necessarily updated in the bill for the section numbering. So it still is in there, and you can see that there's a couple sections that get skipped. But again, that's been taken out. So this is just the standard update connection bill, that point in time that this committee sees on an annual basis.
Thank you. We have one person signed up to speak. John Hawkins, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Hawkins. I'm a member of the Taxation Committee of the Oregon Society of CPAs. I'm a certified public accountant. I'm a partner of a CPA firm here in Salem, and just finished my 33rd tax season, so I'm proud that's over. On behalf of the 4,400 members of the Oregon Society of CPAs, I respectfully testify in support of Senate Bill 213A. The Oregon Society of CPAs has supported a rolling reconnect for a number of years. We list a number of reasons in my written testimony, primarily that it provides simplicity if Oregon rules are in conformity with federal rules as much as possible. There's an ease in preparation of tax returns for taxpayers. Just last Friday, I listened to a webinar by the American Institute of CPAs that reported that 41% of returns that were e-filed this year were prepared by individuals and not through the assistance of a paid preparer. So I think a number of individuals preparing their own returns, and I think that when we have consistency between federal and state, they're likely to make much fewer mistakes. It's ease with the tax advisor community because we can have ease in planning for our clients in knowing what the result will be for federal and state and that the results will be consistent. And I think it also provides benefits to the Oregon Department of Revenue that there's not as many errors in returns and maybe cut back on the amount of correspondence and corrections that they have to make in returns that are processed incorrectly. I remember going back, this bill started off as a static reconnect where we reconnected to a certain date and we stayed stuck with that date. And I remember practicing in those early years when we had a static reconnect and the issues that it created, the legislature would come after you adjourned, federal would pass a new tax law. When we were preparing individual returns, we didn't know whether when we prepared the Oregon return, it had to be prepared differently. But then when you came back, and in those days, it was two-year wait for you to come back and reconnect. We would then go back and have to amend returns to properly prepare those returns according to how Oregon law was that had been revised. So it's very nice that with a rolling reconnect, that Oregon consistently stays in connection with federal law and avoids some unnecessary amendments and complexity. So on behalf of the Oregon Society of CPAs, I respectfully encourage you to support Senate Bill 213-8.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Signed up to testify this morning. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 213A. I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 79A.
Members of the committee, Senate Bill 79A is a measure that was introduced on behalf of the Department of Revenue. And I do have in the meeting materials, I'll call your attention to a table that has the description of changes for Senate Bill 79A. That's a little beneficial explaining exactly what's going on here. But again, 79A is just clarifying and has kind of two parts really, and that's why there's two paragraphs in the SMS, but it's in part clarifying existing authority of Department of Revenue and how they render assistance in the collection of delinquent accounts that are owing to state agency, public universities, and other governments. And again, this is relating to Department of Revenue and their other agency accounts, which is, in a way, is the collection agency for the Department of Revenue for other local governments or other government entities such as the universities as well. And again, as the table shows, the first part of the bill has clarification language that's in response to some of the changes that have happened in other pieces of statute related to, best examples, universities. And then Senate Bill 79A, the column on the right there shows some language that's been changed to provide, in some ways, an expansion of some capabilities and how OAA would be able to collect on debt. There is some nuance to that, and I believe Department of Revenue can speak to some of the differences there, but there is, as you can see in the lower kind of right corner there, it's the refund offset only, and that would be providing assistance through when a taxpayer gets a tax refund, if they have outstanding debt, that tax refund can then be used to apply to that debt is one way that that works. So it's allowing that refund offset program to be to allow local governments and special government bodies per the statutes that you see their reference to be able to have their debt collected through that offset program.
Thank you. Two people have signed up to testify. I hope you don't mind coming up at the same time. Deanna Mack, Wendy Johnson. Deanna, will you please begin?
Yes, thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. And this bill comes to you as our one of our concepts to clarify our collection authority, as Kyle stated, as it relates to entities that we have been providing collection services for in the past. For some background, as a result of 2017's Senate Bill 1067, which was a government efficiency effort, agencies no longer had the choice to send their debts to either our other agency accounts area or a private collection firm. They must go, agencies must make their attempts to collect the debt, and then Senate Bill 1067 now requires them to send it directly to us, and then we manage the relationship with the private collection firms. So each agency doesn't have to do that. But as a result of that efficiency effort, we realized that many of the agencies, such as the university system, community colleges, and entities like SAFE and OHSU, have had their tie to the executive branch of government significantly reduced in the statutes over the years. Remember, it used to be Oregon State System of Higher Education and then Oregon University System. And as time has gone by, it means that it's not clear, as clear as it once was, that we continue to have authority to collect on their behalf. So with the moves over the years to reduce the ties to these entities to the executive branch, this bill clarifies that we can continue to still do the collection services that we have provided in the past, because we think that that's what you didn't intend to actually segregate and require these entities to do collections on their own, given the recent legislative intent to centralize collections and not segregate it. So we've worked with all of our entities that on this bill for which collection services are provided, and they're okay with it. Initially, the private collection firm industry had concerns because they thought it was expanding our current authority to include entities like ports or water districts that we did not have current authority to. And so the A and Gross version corrects that, because that wasn't unintentional in the first version. We also had folks come forward to say, hey, we like this expanded version. We want you guys to do this work for us. And so we worked with AOC, the Association of Oregon Counties, county tax collectors, State Bar, League of Oregon Cities, of course, private collection firms, and then special districts on language to that ended up in the A and Gross version of the bill, which clarifies DOR's original intent, which was just to clarify our role, ability to do this. And like Kyle said, it added a refund offset authority for cities, counties, and special districts, which means if we are issuing a refund in any of our programs, it'll go next. We'll issue the refund, but it'll go to pay the debt owed by that debtor next before it actually goes to that person. And then we also added what we call full collection services for the State Bar, which is the client services, client security fund. And my understanding is that is a very small pool of debtors that are attorneys that have owe something from their client security fund. But that is a very small amount of work for our agency. So if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. But I ask that you support and pass this bill. Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Good morning. When refund offsets occur, are the citizens notified with a reconciled statement?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, that is correct. They get a notification that says, here's the refund we issued and here's where we sent it. And then they have appeal rights to show that they maybe we're an injured spouse, maybe we took on a personal income tax refund and paid the joint refund to a child support debt that's only owed by one person, and we will apportion that refund and give that portion that is owned by the other non-debtor person back to them, so they have appeal rights. They can't dispute with us the underlying debt, because by the time it comes to our agency, it's what's known as liquidated and delinquent. So they've already gone through that process with the client agency, whether it's OHSU or SAFE or whatever agency that is.
I understand that part. What I'm looking for is, can they reconcile? So will the citizen be told you still owe this amount, or this is now the amount of your refund?
Right, Chair Nathanson, right, and Representative Smith, yeah, I believe we do issue statements of account to show the what they still owe for whatever debts they have that we are collecting for.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, lobbyist for the League of Oregon City and Tax, Finance, and Economic Development Issues. This one is a debt delinquency type bill. Usually we're looking for tax bills at the league when I come before you, but this one is, we have taxes, but we're not being paid on those taxes. And so I'm always looking for efficiency on tax collection, and DOR is now collecting for us on marijuana. We'll be on lodging taxes. They are for payroll taxes in a few communities. And so they also do debt collection for the state and are efficient at that. And so this would be adding this to the list of things that would be more efficient for cities to ask for offsets. We still use private debt collectors for much of our debts. This would just allow for the offset program. The bill, as originally written, did allow the full meal deal, if you will, and this just now allows on the offset, so we'll see how that goes. We could be back again, but we do have good relationships with our private debt collectors as well. We want to streamline collections. It doesn't make any sense for two government entities to try to find the debtor and make that collection, so this will make it cheaper for the debt collector or the debtors as well as local governments, and so we fully support the bill. I've been asked what types of debt cities are owed, and it's usually property taxes, which is on the county side, but SDCs, utility bills, and traffic tickets do pile up, and so these are not insignificant amounts, but it's much cheaper for everyone because you don't have to do the whole complicated lien process as well instead of using this offset program. So we and the other local government support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. That completes the list of people speaking to this bill. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 79A. I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 837.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 837 deals with property tax assessment, and so just a tiny bit of background that if you're a property owner and you're not satisfied with the real market value of your property, you can appeal to, starting with the Board of Property Tax Appeals. You can appeal your property tax, your property value, and if through various channels that gets decided in your favor, there's a 5-year adjudication period where that value would remain fixed. You do subsequently have the right to appeal it again if you feel that it is too high in subsequent years, but currently, there's a restricted list of methods for altering the property value in the other direction or raising it during that 5-year adjudication period. And this bill would essentially just say that if the property was sold during that adjudication period, and the property value had been set by, for instance, BOPTA or the Board of Property Tax Appeals, that if the property value or if the property was sold for a higher value, that the property could be revalued to reflect that sale price.
Thank you. And this is all we have. We have one person signed up to speak on this bill. Jeff Brown, please.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Brown. I am the deputy assessor for Multnomah County. I am here to speak to you today and ask for your support for Senate Bill 837. And I thank you for the introduction. So Senate Bill 837 seeks to amend ORS 309.115, otherwise known as the adjudication statute. It also serves to ensure the compliance, Oregon assessor's compliance with ORS 308-232. Senate Bill 837 has the support of the Oregon State Association of County Assessors, also known as OSACA. It also enjoys the support of the Association of Oregon Counties, aka AOC. And last, it has the Oregon Department of Revenue has reviewed the bill and has no concerns. So with that, again, just to restate, when a property owner believes that their real market value is incorrect, they have the right to appeal their real market value in front of one of several tribunals. And that, typically speaking, begins with the Board of Property Tax Appeals. Then from there, they can appeal to the Oregon Tax Court, which houses both the magistrate and the regular division. And then they may also petition the Department of Revenue for a supervisory review. And the Department of Revenue does issue orders for value as well. So if they are successful in the manner, if they're successful, that value reduction, also known as an adjudicated value, how it's handled is prescribed by ORS 309.115, which states that that value is to be held static for a period of 5 years following the order. However, there are numerous exceptions to that, granted in the law for that, eight, in fact, that will allow adjustments to the value. And those are for occurrences such as remodeling, additions, damage to the property, things that you could imagine might happen, might affect the value of a property in that period. So what Senate Bill 837 does, quite simply, is just add a single line to it that adds a sale of the property as the ninth exception to that law. So, and again, as far as ensuring compliance for assessors to 308-232, this is the law. It's a simple law that charges all assessors with one thing, and that's to value all real property at 100% of its real market value every year. And so this, hopefully, this bill will ensure assessors are in compliance with that law. So the issue arises, real quick, when a sale takes place inside that five-year period, and that sale price indicates that the real market value is incorrect. This would allow the appraisers to, the assessors to appraise the property to get the value correct on the roll. And a simple example would be a property is adjudicated at $1 million, and a few years later it sells for $2 million. Well, as the law is written now, it doesn't afford assessors the ability to reappraise and raise that value. And that's what Senate Bill 837 seeks to do, is allow the assessors to appraise the property inside that adjudication period. And with that, I thank you and ask for your support. Happy to answer any questions.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here. So is there a percentage, like, is it, if it's assessed for $1 million and it sells for $1,100,000, I mean, is there any percentage, like if it's more or less than 10%, or is the purpose to just straight up have it be able to change it to whatever it sells for, regardless of whether it's a dollar more or less or $1 million more or less?
Sure, Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith Warner. So I think that would be up to the assessor. Clearly, this is mass appraisal. It's not an exact science. You can't hit the penny on every sale. So it would be up to the assessor. And you know, my opinion is that it would be for those instances where it's clearly out of order. It's clearly not, such as the example that I gave. It's adjudicated in $1 million and sells for $2 million. Clearly something's wrong.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
No other testimony for Senate Bill 837. I am closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 837. I'm moving now to work sessions.
Should we stand at ease for a moment?
We will stand at ease for a moment. I'm going to start on 2184A. I'd like to begin by hearing from LRO, and then I would like to hear from Representative Marsh about how this bill and amendments have developed.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. If you might recall, House Bill 2184A it does two main things. It establishes a broadband fund in connection with the existing Oregon Universal Service Fund. Now, Oregon Universal Service Fund is currently applied to landlines only. This seeks to expand that assessment onto wireless lines and also VoIP. And in that, it reduces the rate of assessment from 8.5%, which is currently applied to wirelines. And the amended version, the Dash 11, changes that rate to 6% for the applicable lines. And then it also establishes a total cap, total annual cap for the fund and for the Oregon Universal Service Fund. That would be $28 million, and the broadband fund with the Dash 11 would be set at a maximum cap of $5 million, and that would be comprised of money that's spilled over from the $28 million of the Oregon Universal Service Fund. And so in looking at the revenue impact and how the Oregon Universal Service Fund is being administered and collected, currently that 8.5% on wirelines is generating a declining revenue because people are leaving landlines. And so you can see that in the first biennium, by bringing in the wireless lines and the VoIP lines, you're sort of growing the pie, and so there's a bump, and so there's an increased revenue. And the first $8 million in the first biennium is going towards the first $2.2 million in comparison with what's being pulled in today. So when we do a revenue impact statement, we're looking at what the bill would do compared to the status quo. And so there would be an additional $2.2 million flowing into the Oregon Universal Service Fund in the first biennium. And it would also generate $8 million for the broadband fund. There's also a few trends that are going on with wireless lines and VoIP carriers. And some of that is that the portion of the bill that this fee is assessable on is the sort of telecom voice portion. So the data and information side is not assessable. And so you know that as we use our phones more for data-driven services and informational services and less for calling people, that sort of stream is shrinking. And so you get this initial bump in the first biennium, but it starts to shrink in later biennium. And if the trend continues, then the third biennium that we're looking at, because we're assessing at 6% versus 8.5%, there might actually be a revenue decrease. It could happen that the market has transformations, those trends change a little.
Thank you. Representative Marsh.
Thank you.
Well, first, I'd just like to run through the details of amendments that have been added to this bill since we had a public hearing on it. And the amendments, which are posted, basically do four things I'd like to highlight that are significant. First, they note that libraries will be a priority for expenditure of any money that comes into the broadband fund. So schools, K-12 broadband systems would be the first priority, libraries would be the second, residential communities would be the third. Secondly, it clearly delineates that planning is an appropriate use of broadband money so that communities can access that money to really put projects together on the ground, as well as to pay for infrastructure at a later point. Third, and these are the significant revenue changes here, it moves the maximum surcharge from 7% in the bill that we talked about a few weeks ago down to 6%, and it adjusts the maximum to be collected from the basic fund from $30 million to $28 million, and in the broadband piece of the fund from $10 million to $5 million. We made those changes because we wanted to be as targeted as possible and as specific as possible in the amount of money to be raised by the bill. I want to say just a word about the long-term revenue projections. Telecommunications is an industry that is, if anything, rapidly changing. As we use different devices, we access our communications in different ways. What we do know is that the current fund is in trouble because it relies solely on landlines. That's the only entity that is required to pay into the fund. And we know that landlines are shrinking. We've seen that evidence in the past. We know that will continue. What we don't know exactly is what will happen to the rest of the telecommunications industry over a period of time, how cell phones will continue to predominate, what will happen to the growth of the VoIP industry, how those bills will reflect the safe harbor portion that can actually be accessed by a surcharge. But we believe that the risk of doing nothing is greater than the risk of moving into the new age of telecommunications and incorporating cell phones and VoIP and the other means of communication into the basic universal service charge.
Thank you for that explanation. Any questions yet from the committee?
I have a question, Madam
Yes.
Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Marsh. I appreciate where we are with this, I realize it's been somewhat of a rocky road to get here, and great work. I appreciate the heck out of that. I have one issue that the prevailing issue for me is when we get to the grant portion and the broadband portion, is that the amount of money that's available from the federal component for this program is incredible. I mean, the most recent USDA stuff that came out talked about $200 million for grants, $200 million for grants and loans and combinations. And I would hope that the focus of whatever we do for state funds for this broadband would be to leverage and work as diligently as we can to bring in federal monies and to exclude as many state funds as we can. From the USDA contacts that I've had and other conversations, there's brink trucks just driving around with cash falling out the back door. We need to go figure out how to get it and save our tax dollars, our Oregon tax dollars, wherever we can. So I would just offer that. Thank you.
Can I respond to that?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Rep. Finley, for those comments. And I couldn't agree more with you. I mean, certainly we want to get our share of that federal money, although the first words I've gotten on the street is that it's complicated to get that money, but we need to be doing that. I think having a flow of state funding that is flexible, that can be used for planning, for really gearing up those projects, for leveraging that federal money, for matching when necessary, is really critical to our ability to fully access the federal money. Clearly, what we can raise on the state level is a drop in the bucket in terms of the infrastructure costs necessary for the remote areas in which we're really talking about using this money. So this money in no way will supplant. What we hope it will do is really just leverage whatever funding we can get in from private sources as well as from federal ones. And I believe there's some language in the bill that actually talks about using the money to really pull in federal money as well.
Thank you. Are we ready to consider an amendment?
You
ready? You want
to do it? Madam Chair, I move that the A-11 amendment be adopted in the House Bill 2184A.
Representative Finley moves the -A11 amendment into 2184A. Any discussions on this amendment? Any objections? Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2184A as amended with a due pass recommendation to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Finley moves House Bill 2184A as amended with the due pass recommendation of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion on the main motion. Objections. Representative Reschke. Recording. Motion passes. Thank you. That concludes our business on this bill. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2184A. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2456A.
Okay, good morning, Madam Chair. members of the members of the committee. House Bill 2456A is a bill that comes to the committee from the House Committee on Agriculture and Land Use. The underlying portion of the bill, there are changes that are affecting lands within the Eastern Oregon Border Economic Development Region, and it is allowing the development of, in some cases, residential property of a lot or a parcel of 2 acres or more per the specified parameters in the bill, and there are those parameters are then specified. There is an overall limitation on the rezoning of not more than 200 acres in this area, and that is relating to the rezoning of exclusive farm use land. Now, the reason, or probably the reason, that this bill came to the Revenue Committee is in 2456, the A version, there are two components, one related to property tax special assessment and a continuation of that special assessment during a specific time period during this rezoning and potential development. And then also there was the creation of an income tax credit of up to $5,000 for these newly constructed residential property. Now the -A6 amendment that's up there in OLIS removes that property tax portion and the income tax portion. So it's probably fair to say that with the A6, removing those two portions, this bill otherwise wouldn't be in front of the new committee if this amendment had been adopted in the agriculture and land use. So that's kind of the hook of how it came to this committee. So again, the A6, there's also some clarification and conforming changes, adding the word rezoned in front of lands throughout the bill. But again, the key component for this committee is it's removing that hook. It's removing the changes, the policy changes to the property tax and the income tax credit. So those are taken out in the A6.
Thank you. Committee, this bill is here with us, as LRO has explained, because it had property tax and income tax work. It no longer has the property tax and income tax pieces to it. The bill doesn't need to be in the Revenue Committee. It wouldn't have come to us if this had been taken out in the other committee. It's being taken out now. And because the amendment is to remove those pieces, I believe it is not necessary to have a public hearing on this bill. We just need to have a work session and move it along as it was prepared by the prior policy committee. That's where those discussions were held. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As we're starting to have conversations on House Bill 2456A, I do not have a conflict of interest, but I do serve as the Economic Development Director. My company does, and my team does, for Malheur County. And so I just want to make sure as everyone's deliberating, they know that role I play in Malheur County.
Thank you. Is there a motion to amend the bill?
Rep. Nathanson, I move the Dash 6 amendment be adopted in House Bill 2456A.
Representative Marsh moves the Dash A 6 amendment into 2456A. Is there a discussion? Objections? Motion passes.
Chair Nathanson, I move House Bill 2456A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Marsh moves 2456A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, colleagues, I just want everyone to know that a company that I'm a member of has a team of folks that do economic development in Malheur County. There's no financial gain to be had from this. I actually had nothing to do with this legislation, but I just want the public to know that.
Thank you. Any other discussion on the motion? Any objections? Motion passes. I think Representative Finley would like to carry this bill.
I believe I would. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
There's no other work to do on this bill, is that correct? I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2456A. We have completed our work for today. We are adjourned.